Happy Monday, everybody. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I have a very special guy with me. I've just enjoyed our conversation in the green room. I'm sorry it wasn't live, but Adam Nitzner is with me tonight. He has written just a ton of outstanding legal thrillers, and it makes sense to me because he is, of course, an attorney. He is about an hour outside of New York City. I'm going to let you hear all about it from his own mouth, but he is with the firm that from which Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor came from, and I think that's amazing. It's my pleasure to welcome to Authors on the Air, Adam Nitzner. Adam, thank you so much for being with me tonight. Totally enjoyed our pre-show conversation. Let's talk some more.
Great to be here, Pam. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. First, I want to congratulate you on all the success that you've had with your books. I've read all of them. It looks like the most recent one, Dead Certain, is a runaway bestseller, hugely popular. And I can't say that I blame anybody for stating that, because Ella Borden is an amazing character. And you've really created something special there. So tell me about how this book came into being for you. I'm so fascinated by this story.
Well, this book for me is an important one because I have two daughters who are much younger than the sisters in the book. Mm-hmm. But they kind of form the basis for Ella and her sister Charlotte, in so much as this idea about people who are being true to themselves and the secrets that people keep from their families. So those were kind of the issues that I wanted to explore. And Ella is a character who is a lawyer, but has a secret desire to be an artist, in her case, a singer. And so in that regard, I find similarities with Ella, with me in particular, because I'm a lawyer and had a secret life as a writer that I wanted to pursue. But also my children are both actor types, and they're still in school, but going through the decision about, am I going to try to pursue what I'm passionate about in a creative field as a vocation, or am I going to do something that will be more easily will allow me to more easily pay the bills and, you know, give that dream up. And so those were the issues that I was thinking about with the book. And so with Ella and her sister Charlotte, I got to explore a little bit the difference between Ella, who takes the safer road to become a lawyer and has this desire to still fuel her artistic self, which, like I said, I think is the way I did it. And Charlotte, who was pursuing her passion as a writer from the beginning, which, frankly, is what I hope my daughters will end up doing. But we'll see.
I want to read from Kirkus Reviews. They said, Dead Certain's leading coincidence, which is quite a whopper, is offset by an equally dazzling surprise. It packs enough of a punch to make it worth reading. Boy, that's an understatement. It really is a terrific book. And if I hear you correctly, you were saying that you hope that your daughters pursue their creative side versus the pragmatic part of their life.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that it's a decision that they'll have to make, like it's a decision, you know, everybody has to make for themselves. And I'm not against the idea of people saying, well, I really should do something that's pragmatic with my life and have the creative parts of my life be more secondary. And I think it's really up to everybody to make their own decision about that. But one of the regrets that I have about my life is that I didn't come to writing until much later in my life, when I was already established as a lawyer. And it's been, you know, great for me, And, you know, this part of my life with the success that I've had writing has been something that, you know, I kind of never imagined happening for me. But at the same time, I sometimes think, oh, it would have been wonderful to have tried to do this when I was in my 20s. And so with my daughters, I'm a big believer in saying to them, you know, when you graduate from school, you should try to be an actress or try to be a singer. And, you know, there might come a time when you say this isn't working and I need to have a more stable job. And that's fine, too. But it's, I always think a mistake when people say, well, it's just so hard to make it, and so I'm not even going to try. And so in that regard, I do hope that my daughters try their hand at a creative profession before they try the more practical one.
So it's a follow your passion first, I think is what I hear you saying, correct?
Yeah, it is. Although I have to say that I kind of temper it because it's not what I did. And it can still turn out okay if you don't do that. And so I'm not kind of a zealot in that area and saying, well, this is the only way of doing it. I think there are lots of ways to find your a creative outlet in your life and to really feel fulfilled with your passions. But I do think that it's really important to have them and to pursue them, whether it be as your job or just as a hobby or, you know, just something that interests you.
Yes. So I want to continue kind of talking about this because it's very interesting to me that you said, you know, I kind of have a regret that I didn't start writing in my 20s. However, having heard you say that, you write stunningly amazing legal thrillers. I mean, they're just so good, and you're quite successful at it. And so do you think you would have been writing legal thrillers or without the knowledge that you have and without your experience as an attorney? Or do you think you may have written something else? You may have, I don't know, maybe tried a different genre.
Yeah, I don't see how I could have written legal thrillers if I didn't have the life experience that I have. Mm-hmm. And it amazes me when I read people who are writing about something that I know that they don't have firsthand experience about. And when it's, you know, sometimes I think, well, this doesn't ring quite true to me, and that might be part of the reason. And other times I think, I don't know how you can get that kind of experience without living it firsthand. So for me, no, I don't think it would have been possible to write legal thrillers if I hadn't spent a lot of time in the law. Not so much because you can't do the research about the legal issues. That's the easy part. But that you don't meet the personalities that form the basis for the characters that you find in the legal system. That I would have found hard. That being said, you know, I would have led some type of other life, and I probably would have found those characters. But at least for me, you know, one of the reasons I think I probably didn't write in my 20s and 30s was because I didn't have anything really to write about or experiences that
a
I
life
was,
experience. Yes.
Right. So,
interesting.
You know, even, you know, in part, like before I was married, I don't think that I could have written about marriages in the way that I feel like I can now. And certainly, you know, before I had children, I didn't think I could write about families in that way. And so, like I said, I know people who are either not married or don't have children and write beautifully about it. But for me, it was like I was learning it, and it was different. So, you know, I make that point also. It's about everything, about like loss or grieving. You know, these are things that I thought that I knew about, either from books or from just imagining or whatever. And then when you experience it directly, you say, yeah, it's a little bit different than I thought it was.
Interesting. What you say makes sense. But I have to tell you that being a fan of your books, and particularly Dead Certain, it just really blew me away. It just really blew me away. It was an amazing book. So I'm happy that things work the way they work for you. I was having a discussion about you this afternoon with one of the other hosts in the network, and I was stating that you were an attorney and that Justice Sotomayor came from the same law firm. And he said to me, it's interesting to him that so many attorneys write books, which is true. Do you think it's because you write briefs? I mean, basically your job, no matter what, is writing.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I think that as a lawyer, you write all the time. And also, you know, brief writing is very different from fiction writing. But
sure.
There's the practice of writing is similar in the sense that, you know, you're not, you know, some people are overwhelmed with the idea that they have to write 3 pages. And lawyers, they're used to the idea that it's hard to limit yourself to 20 pages in a brief. And the editing process is something that you're used to. I also think one of the things that was really good for me is when you think about being a student, you write your papers, and I was always a good writer in school, but there isn't all that much editing by other people that happens when you're in school. Your professor or teacher might criticize you a little bit, but you don't rewrite it after you get your grade. But mm-hmm. as a lawyer, when particularly a junior lawyer, there are people editing your work all the time, and it really helps you learn how to write better because you see how they've improved it. And so I do think that there's a lot of knowledge that you get from being a lawyer in writing. And the other thing is, most the people I know who are lawyers and writers, there's a rich area of characters and fact patterns to draw on. And so people ask me if any of the cases that I work on in my real life end up in my books. And the answer is no, because, you know, my real life cases aren't anywhere as interesting as the fictional cases I write about.
Mm-hmm.
But the
mm-hmm.
people and the kind of little ticks that the characters have, yeah, a lot of that is from real life.
Interesting. Yeah, I would imagine. I have a brother who's an attorney. He's a litigator, so he writes a lot of briefs. I think that when you talk about editing briefs and all, especially junior partners and all, it is interesting to me that you said that because it seems to me you learn to write with just the facts. You are stating the facts of a case. And quite honestly, most books these days, that's what you want to do. You don't need a lot of heavy prose and narrative. And quite honestly, books are shorter than they used to be. People want more of a moving story. They want the action that comes along, particularly in thrillers. Do you find that to be so?
I do. I mean, I think it's a balance. And I know that for me, I like a book with some heft, but I wouldn't say that I'm intimidated from a 500 or 600 page book as much as I don't know if I have the time commitment to give to it.
Right.
And so my books have always been around 350 pages. And
right.
That's kind of like when I do the first draft and it's significantly longer than that, I think, yeah, it's probably too long. And my chapters, too, tend to be rather short. And for me, at least, as much as other books form the basis for my writing style, I think television and movies do too. And
yes.
I hear from a lot of people that my books are somewhat cinematic, like that you can visualize them pretty easily.
Yes.
And when you watch television or the movies, the scenes are really quick. And yet
yes.
in a novel, sometimes it could be 20, 30 pages of people sitting around a dinner table. But you never, you know, and that'll take you, you know, half hour to read, right? But you never see
sure.
a half hour scene around a dinner table, you know,
right.
in a movie or television. So I do think it moves it much faster if you're scenes are shorter, and the book itself moves the action along more quickly.
I have to say that in reading Dead Certain, it felt, well, one, I'm a huge reader. I read about 400 books a year, so, and I don't own a television anymore. I haven't for a long time, but I like shorter chapters because if I must put down a book to pause for any reason, I don't feel like I'm stopped in the middle of a scene. And I think that I understand what you're saying. Your books feel episodic to me. And I mean that in all the good ways. It continuously flows, but the scene changes all the time, and I'm riveted to what you have to say. That's a good thing, I think, as a reader. I mean, for me, it keeps me in a book, and quite honestly, I don't care about the length of a book. I don't care if it's novella length. I don't care if it's 1,000 pages, as long as it's moving all the time forward, whether it's action or dialogue or a combination of both. What is difficult for me, and I guess one of the reasons I don't read a lot of literary fiction, is because I don't need you to tell me about the sea or the sky or the wind, and I don't want to know about angst in every scene. Maybe I'm just not that smart, Adam, and that's probably what it is. But
no,
you know,
I don't know you, Pam, so I can't speak to your intelligence level, but I'm assuming you are that smart. And I'll tell you that I do read literary fiction from time to time, but I never finish it. And it's a running joke that I have with my wife, who reads a lot of literary fiction, and I don't think has ever not finished a book. And she'll say to me, "What do you mean you're not going to finish?" And I'll say to her, "I think I've gotten what I need to get out of this book. Like, I don't really care that much about how it ends. I've enjoyed reading what I've read, you know, understanding the style, and some of the passages are really pretty. And that's it for me. I'll go into something else."
I feel so much better that you're saying this to me, Adam. I have to tell you, because I was kind of feeling like a real dummy. I like the action of a story. I like a fast-paced story, whether it's – and I read multiple genres. So, you know, whether it's romance or you know, urban fantasy or steampunk or science fiction, thrillers and mystery, all of it. I like all of it. But it's got to keep moving. It can't be this slow buildup to action. I want something right in the first chapter. So I'm kind of like you, I guess, in that regard. Thank you for making me feel better about my
– Well, I mean, I feel the same way. And, like, one of the things that I think about, like, I remember being in high school when we were studying Shakespeare. And one of the things – and, you know, how much do you remember from high school, right? But I remember the teacher saying –
We're not going
often,
there, Adam.
often starts
we're not going
plays
there.
With
uh-huh.
parties. Because
right.
Everybody's there, and it's kind of exciting. And I always think about, like, I want to start my books with, you know, something that's exciting. And so
right.
I met with a publisher years ago who told me the murder should be on the first page. And I don't always do that. But I always try to have something, you know, right off the bat that you're in this world that's exciting.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that, I mean, it should be – reading should be because it really kind of gets your heart racing. And I respect people who feel that way because the language is beautiful or they like a slow story. That's fine too. But, you know, I'm more of an action person myself. And so that's what it's about for me.
I think that Amazon made subgenres for people like you and I, you know, because while it used to be, as we all recall, going to a library, you went to the fiction section or the nonfiction section and maybe the self-help section or cookbooks. But I too like action in a story, and I'm sure that there's plenty of literary fiction where there is action, but and maybe it's our short attention span type of a behavior nowadays that, you know, give it to me on the first chapter. I need something to sink my teeth into. And I always thought for me, and you're probably the same way because you read a lot too, I always thought, you know, I have an embarrassment of riches. I am privy to and honored to receive so many galleys from so many wonderful authors that if I don't like the book immediately, I can put it to the side and go on to something else and really don't feel too badly about that. So I'm a very fickle reader, I will say that. It's sad, isn't it?
Well, no, but I think that reading is a real investment of time, and so you have to enjoy it. You have to enjoy the characters and the story, which doesn't necessarily mean you want to, you know, they have to love them in the sense that they have to be good people, but they have to be intriguing people that you're going to want to. So I think
invested in somehow in the character and the story. It has to resonate with me. Interesting. You still practice law full time, I'm assuming.
I do.
And would you like to continue practicing law full time, or would you prefer to be at a point where you can stop it? Or does it feed your creative side?
I think the answer is yes to all those facets.
Interesting.
Certainly there is a part of me that I will wake up and I'll have a really good idea for my book and realize I have to go to the office. And so I would dream about a time when that was not my life, where I could wake up and just start writing. I also wonder if I had Monday through Friday to write, whether I could write more. You know, right now I've been putting out a book a year for the last 3 or 4 years. There's no way I could do more than that. But would I, you know, write articles or just have more time for thinking? Yeah, I would like that. At the same time, when I have these discussions with my agent, he always says to me, among the writers that he represents, that he thinks the people who give up their day jobs, their writing suffers. And he says it's both because they're not experiencing the world the same way, and also because there happens to be something about being busy that causes you to manage your time better. And so,
how interesting to me that you said something that resonates with me very much, and you said you like to spend time thinking. And I think that I just read an article, a blog, as a matter of fact, that the most successful CEOs dedicate about 20% of their time thinking. And I probably part of that is daydreaming or imagining or, you know, just kind of letting your mind wander. Do you find that's what you do in your thinking time?
It is. And one of the things that I like about writing, I truly, truly love being at the keyboard and writing. But I also really like the thinking part of it. And it's a joke that I have with my wife sometimes where I'll tell her I'm going to write and I'll sit at the keyboard and she'll say, "You're not doing anything." And I'll say, no, this is part of it. This is me writing. Just because there are no words today doesn't mean it's not a pretty productive day if I'm thinking out characters or what's the story going to look like later and who are these people? And I find it, you know, it's almost like telling yourself a story. And that's the part that I like the best, is because, you know, I'm thinking through the story, so it's like I'm reading it. And that's the way I like to write, in that I wonder what's going to happen next kind of way, in the same way that I read.
That's interesting. When you are in your thinking zone, and I recognize that's still all part of the creative process, are you kind of imagining a story, or do you already have an idea, Adam, and you kind of just close your eyes and visualize that story? Or does it come to you kind of once you put your fingers down on the keyboard? Does it, the story come first, or do the characters? And which do you think about most when you're in that zone of contemplation?
For me, it depends on where I am in the process. So if I'm just starting out thinking about what's this book going to be about, normally what I'm thinking is some sort of broad theme. Like for Dead Certain, I was thinking about the secrets you don't share with your family, you know. And
right.
then as another theme, the idea of who are we really? Are we the people that we feel inside, or are we the people who we project to others? So I have that general idea. But then I'm thinking about the characters. And so with Dead Certain, the idea that it was going to be these two sisters was the first breakthrough. And even that was a big deal because, you know, it's written in the first person from a female point of view. And when
yes.
I first told my agent I was going to do that, he said, really? You know, can they be brothers? And I just thought, you know, first of all, my experience of watching siblings is my daughters. And so I felt like in
sure.
a weird way I knew a sister relationship better than I knew a brother relationship because I don't have a brother. And then I just thought, no, I think that brothers don't have the same kind of relationship the sisters do. It's really
got to
be a sister story. So then it was, okay, what's the story going to actually be? And I think that a lot of people who don't know writers but read think that it's the other way. And I did, personally. And when I started becoming friends with more and more people who wrote, I was surprised at how many of them, almost all of them, say the same thing that I say, which is, no, I don't really plot that much. I don't necessarily know who did it until midway through. And I just think the book works much better that way, though I will say that there are moments of panic where you say, what if I don't figure it out? You know, what if there's not a spark? And one of the things that I find the most satisfying for me in my arc as a writer is that I'm no longer that terrified of that. So right now I'm maybe 100 pages into the writing of not my next book, but the book after that. And I'm not sure how it's going to end, but I'm not terrified that I won't figure it out. Like, I'm pretty sure that I will by the time it's done, because I've, you know, now done it 6 or 7 times. But the first couple of times I remember thinking, oh, I could be spending a lot of time on this and never figure it out, and that would be terrible.
Well, so you decided to write sisters. It was indeed in first person point of view, which was, it was brilliant, I thought. Did you find yourself reading your dialogue out loud to ensure that you had an authentic voice there?
I do. I do read the dialogue out loud. I edit the dialogue much more than I edit the prose, I think, for that reason. And it's funny because even silly things, you know, which I'm now conscious of when I'm thinking about when I'm reading or I'm watching a movie or something like that, you know, think about how infrequently in a dialogue will you mention the other person's name, right?
Yes.
Will you call, well, I'll say, well, Pam, right? Like, that just doesn't happen that much in real dialogue.
Right.
And when
right.
it does, like, I think about how often do I call my wife by her name? Kind of only when I'm mad at her, right? Like, I don't normally do it in a regular conversation.
Right.
And so, like, that kind of stuff, I do. And one of the things, when you're writing dialogue, sometimes you want to put in those signifiers so the reader can tell who's speaking. But I find it rings false because it's just not the way people talk.
Yeah, I'm glad that you do that. I was speaking to someone who's trying to write a book, and I said, oh, you know, just remember to read your dialogue to see if it's authentic. And he said to me, wow, I went back and read what I wrote, and it was really lousy. And I said, you know, The other thing I notice is, and maybe you'll tell me if this is a sticking point for you, when you have characters, you have the two genders in your story, unless you're writing solely, you know, about two characters and that's it, the two sisters. But the way that men and women or boys and girls or young people speak, male and female, is totally different. The timbre, the cadence, the words they use and all. Are you aware of that when you're writing?
I try to be. Because one of the things is you want all the characters to be different and you want them to sound different.
Yes.
Because they are different. And
yes.
So one of the things that is helpful for me is I often will be thinking about the character as some type of composite of people that I actually know. And so I will try to be thinking about, well, what would she say in this situation, or what would, you know, this person say. And it's not just, you know, male, female, but older, younger. I think that's
yes.
all, it's all true. And I think you do want, you know, you do want to be in a situation where if you just read the dialogue that somebody would say, well, I know who's the speaker. In the same way that, like, among your friends, if someone said, which one of your friends said this, generally speaking, you'd know which one of your friends said without any more qualification, because it would just
sure.
fit that person.
Yes,
and
yes.
And so I think if the dialogue is good, it should work that way too.
Absolutely. I want to kind of get off writing for just a minute, because you have so many other interesting things going on. When we were in the green room, we had a discussion about one of the things that you like to collect that I just had to laugh out loud about. You are a Pez dispenser nut job, aren't you?
I am.
And
I
say that with all love and respect, but you collect a cray-cray amount of Pez dispensers. How did you start this, when and why?
I started collecting Pez. I don't even remember why I started, but it was over 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, and it just became something that I was interested in, and it was a fairly inexpensive thing to collect. And so it was a time when I had lots of friends who were doctors and lawyers and bankers, and they were collecting wine or watches or, you know, stuff that was of art. And I was collecting Pez, and it was easy to do, and it was fun for me because I'm a big fan of pop culture and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I have two different collections. I have the Pez collection, which I keep at home, and we have them mounted on our wall in the apartment, which I think everyone likes, though I do see a lot of eye rolls when people come in. But when my kids were little, it was a point of real pride. Do you want to see my dad's Pez collection? And I also have a Batman bobblehead collection that I keep in my office, which I'm also quite proud of, as mindless collections go. So,
well,
and
it's
a lot of fun for me.
I want to talk about Batman, though, because, you know, your profile picture is Batman. And I don't know, we may have to come to blows on this one, but in your humble opinion, who is the best Batman?
Well, it's hard, because I'm old enough that I grew up with the TV Adam West Batman.
Right, Adam West.
And so,
as I'm...
he has a very soft spot in my heart. But the writer part of me realizes that if you think about Batman as a real character and a real person, well, he wouldn't have been the Adam West Batman. I think
right.
he probably would have been the Ben Affleck Batman, and even meaner than the Ben Affleck Batman. So each iteration of Batman I've actually embraced, because I like the darker they get. And so, you know, the big turn, I guess, was when Michael Keaton was Batman, and there was a lot of criticism about whether he was well cast and how dark it was, but that seemed about right to me. And I love the Christian Bale movies because that also seemed about right to me. And I like Ben Affleck as Batman too because I think it is a very, very dark character. And so it should be portrayed that way.
Well, he is a dark character, except that I found that I like the Keaton iteration of Batman. So we might have to agree to disagree on that. I liked the playfulness of it quite a bit. It was and not dark. I mean, there were parts of it that were. But, you know, we'll see. Now, we'll see with all the, you know, the Avengers movies and everything else that are coming out. I kind of like all those. I'm with you on all that. I like them dark. But I do like them also campy. So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. I have my calendar marked every time there's a new comic movie coming out.
Yes, we're going to have a big family outing to see Justice League. And it happens that this week is the premiere of the Agatha Christie movie. And
yes.
My wife is a huge Agatha Christie fan. And so we're going to have a family outing for that as well.
Yeah. Now, who is it that directed that one? I just heard it on NPR today that movie
was going
to come. I
know Kenneth Branagh stars in it. I don't know if he directed it as well.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in that one, too. It should be very fascinating to see that one, to see that iteration of that particular one. So, fun. What's next for you? When we talked in the green room, you mentioned that you don't want to say you have a sequel or whatever for your next book, but we will be seeing more of characters from Dead Certain. Is that your plan right now?
More than my plan. So my next book is called Never Goodbye, and it comes out in April. And it is a sequel of sorts. It continues Ella's story, though it's got more facets to it than just that. And it takes place 6 months after Dead Certain ends. So that's what's next. And I just submitted that and went through the editing process on that book, and I'm very, very pleased with the way it came out. And as soon as one's submitted, I start working on the next one. So I'm writing, and what I'm writing now is not a continuation of Ella's story because I felt like I needed a little bit of a break from that. But
do you think you might go back to Ella?
I'm certain that I will. And so normally my sort of timeline in my head is when I'm about two-thirds done with what I'm working on, I start thinking about, well, what's the next book going to be? And I've started a little early to think about that. And I'm thinking it'll most likely be back in Ella's world, though I don't know if it'll be about her necessarily. But there are so many characters in the Dead Certain and now in the Never Goodbye, the sequel world, that I really like. And I think a lot of them could certainly anchor a book quite well. And so I'm looking forward to getting back to that in a little bit.
I like when ancillary characters kind of take on a life of their own and call out for their own story. So good for you for doing that. I'll be very anxious to read the next one. We're almost out of time. As a matter of fact, I've taken up a lot of your time, but will you play Final Five with me, which is five quick questions and five quick answers before I let you go?
I'll do my best.
Okay. So, well, it's really easy. It's all things you know. We're not retaking the LSAT, so you don't have to study it. But when you are writing, are you in a dedicated quiet space, or do you mind noise around you? Do you have music? What is the tone and tenor of your writing space?
Well, I live in New York City in an apartment with four children and my wife and a dog and a cat. So it's never that quiet. But and sometimes I listen to music and sometimes I don't. It really depends. But I have a dedicated space where I write, and occasionally, like, people or kids will come in, and I'll say, I'm at the office here. and they'll laugh. So it's not a cone of silence sanctuary, but it's a happy place and a quiet enough place.
So they were so respectful of your time and place, right? I imagine they're not yet they're not quite adults yet.
They're closing in, so they range from 14 to 20.
Oh, there you go. Okay. All right. So they're not respectful at all. I get that. I remember that feeling well. So, whose book is on your nightstand, Adam?
You know, now you've caught me because I'm reading something I like a lot and I can't remember the title because it's on Kindle. And so I don't remember exactly what it is, which is a problem.
Yeah.
So I have to pass on that one. I just don't remember the title.
What do you do for fun? What do you do in your spare time? Spare time being the operative word, I know, but what do you like to do?
Well, in a real way, writing is a spare time thing for me. I like spending time with my kids and my wife, and reading.
Excellent. What would we be surprised to learn about you?
I don't know. I don't know what people would think that they knew about me. So it's hard for me to guess what people would think that they'd be surprised about.
I mean, the Pez thing was pretty surprising to me because you seem like a pretty serious guy. So
well,
that you're not so serious.
Because I mean, that's my point exactly. Like, to me, I don't think I'm serious a guy, but I certainly understand that many people think that. And so, yes, I think it's probably right that the Pez collection – oh, well, here's one.
Okay.
I have a briefcase, carry a Batman backpack with me
for
work
God.
And in court. And
oh,
so
my God.
And I don't even think about it. And occasionally I'll be in court and someone will say – are you a lawyer? Because, you know, I have a lawyer ID and I'm dressed like a lawyer. And I'm like, yeah, I keep my books in a Batman backpack. So, yeah, so that surprises people.
That's a good one. Okay. On a serious note, before I let you go, when you look back at your first book and you look at your current book, the one that you're just finishing up, what differences do you see in yourself and in your writing style?
Well, I have to say, I don't reread my books. And so in that regard, I have never read A Conflict of Interest since I finished it. But I do think that my writing is getting better with each book. I think the concepts that I'm writing about are getting more refined. You know, A Conflict of Interest, my first book, is also my longest book. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's not coincidental either. Like, I think I edit much more now. And in a weird way, there are parts of A Conflict of Interest that I really like. And one of the things I like about it is it's a different experience when you're writing, not thinking anyone's ever going to read it, right? Because I didn't have a contract. I had written books prior to A Conflict of Interest that weren't published. And so there's a little bit of a liberating aspect to writing, thinking, well, this is kind of just for me. Whereas when now I'm writing, I imagine people reading it or what are they going to say on the Amazon reviews about it. And I try to block that out so it doesn't impact. But in a little way, mm-hmm. I like the fact that my earlier books might have been purer because I wasn't thinking about any of that. You know, how's it going to sell? Who's going to review
sure.
it? And it's hard
sure.
not to do that now.
Interesting. Adam Mitzner, it has been just a joy talking to you. I hope that you'll come back to the show when the next book is released and let us chat again.
I would love to. This has been great fun.
It's been a lot of fun for me, too. I want to thank you so much for being with me tonight. I wish you and your family a delightful holiday season and best of luck and much success with the next book. Thank you for being
thank
with me,
so
Adam.
Thank you so much, Pam. Take care.
Have
bye
a
bye.
Nice evening. Bye-bye. And that's our show for tonight, folks. I'll be here tomorrow with Greg Barth, whose new book is called Bloodletting. This show is sponsored by Betrayed, the Anthology, which is published by the Authors on the Air Press. You can go to books2read.com, Betrayed, all platforms, or go to Amazon and find Betrayed. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.